Come in.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh, it's Colby.
You have a nasty habit of surviving. Well, you know what they say about the fittest?
All right, yeah! Oh, you know what that sound means, guys. You know what that sound means. It is time for another episode of Young Persons Radio right here on Radio Free Brooklyn with me, your host, Colby Smith, the only program on the airwaves where you, the listener, are guaranteed to be cooler than the host. That's right. If you came for laughs, if you came for a good time, if you came for a good way to start off your Sunday morning, then you are in the right place. I'm Colby Smith. I host this program every week at this time. We are kicking off the first live show of the day, which is 13 straight hours of live talk right here on Radio Free Brooklyn, continuing all the way through until, I guess, 11 p.m. this evening. So enjoy that. This, I am usually coming to you live. This is a live program where I take calls and talk to some of the coolest and most interesting people I know in the city. But as a surprise for you all, we are pre-recorded today for the first time ever, which is a format that we're trying out. So we'll see how it goes. I'm feeling really good about it. And why is that? Well, because I have in the studio joining me the first ever repeat guest for the show for Young Persons Radio. And his name, you know him, it's Matt Strickland.
What up?
You're back.
I'm back. I just couldn't stay away. I had too much fun the first time. I'm also super honored to be your first repeat customer.
Hey,
so thank you for having me.
You were the first person I thought of when I knew I was going to have to pre-record an episode this week.
Oh, that makes me so happy.
Yeah,
my cockles.
As everyone's hearing this, I am in Pittsburgh, tabling at the Pittsburgh Indie Comics Fest for a book called 18 to 24, which is short stories that me and my friend Max Winters wrote. So if you want to hear more about that and how you can read or buy, preferably both, the thing, then definitely hit me up.
And I am in Wildwood, New Jersey, shooting a music video for my very talented friend, Katie Slyker.
Oh, both up to interesting projects.
Well,
on
you,
this day.
You plugged your thing, so I wanted to do my thing too.
I mean, I welcome it.
Oh, thank you.
This is a huge platform, Matt. This is a huge platform.
Yeah, I can't wait for that'll probably get me one click from Tim Keck.
Great. So, I want to. So the reason we're here today is because Matt and I, we are piloting on this very program a new show that we'll be doing.
A podcast
together.
Well, we were just chatting at a bar the other day, and we were like, you know what there's not enough of? Podcasts.
Mm-hmm. Nobody's doing them.
Of white guys in Brooklyn talking about the cinema. There's not enough of those. The people, it's just a market that I think is not flooded.
I don't think so either. I think there's a huge hole in it, and I think people are crying out for it. And I mean, you know, I prove every week I've got my ear to the ground with this show, and what people want is what we're giving them.
Yeah,
now.
Especially us, because we are going to do a podcast about the cinema, and everyone's always saying, Colb, you got great opinions. You got great opinions about films. We love listening to them. We want to hear more of them. Yeah. I wish there was an organized structure. For your opinions to be a platform for them.
Yeah, yeah. And we're answering those calls today.
Mm-hmm.
So but I think it's I think
welcome.
It's both of us I think it's fair to say that movies mean a lot to both of us.
Yeah.
And I mean we're going to talk more about that in a moment, but you know, we're excited to share, you know, our cinematic journeys.
Yes.
with everybody. But enough vamping.
Yeah.
Enough vamping.
No more vamp.
Let's get into it. We're going to take a quick musical break, and then get into it. Right here on Radio Free Brooklyn. This is Young Persons Radio. I'm your host, Colby Smith. I'm joined in the studio today by Matt Strickland, and we will be back in just a moment. Hello, everybody.
Hey, guys. Welcome to The Best Cast, the podcast where Colby Smith and Matt Strickland review every Best Picture winner ever.
That's right. Not in any particular order.
Nope. Just whatever order we feel like it.
That's right. So over the next however many weeks, we're going to go through...
Years.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. For as long as there are Best Picture winners, we're going to do an episode review per Best Picture winner in no particular order and go through every single one.
Yeah, we're going to tell you what we liked about the films, what we didn't like about the films, and also whether or not we thought that that was a deserving Best Picture winner.
Exactly.
And spoiler alert, a lot of them... we got some problems with.
Yep. Don't want to tip our hand here.
Yeah. We'll get to those.
And the movie that we chose to kick things off is the 1945 or the 1946 Best Picture winner, The Lost Weekend.
The most startling novel of the decade, brought to the screen with uncompromising frankness, pulling no punches, knowing full well the storm it would cause. For this is a relentless, terrifying tale of five lost days and nights, torn from a man's life, bearing his heart and soul. The Lost Weekend, starring Ray Milland in one of the great performances of motion picture history. And Jane Wyman as the girl who shared his desperate journey into fear.
You just happen to walk in on this. Now, if you know what's good for you, you'll turn around and walk out again. And walk fast and don't turn back.
Down strange, forbidden byways, he wandered in search of his soul. One woman loved him too much to let him lose it. Another wanted him enough to take him without it.
You do like me a little, don't you, honey?
Why, Nat, Gloria, Nat.
You just heard the trailer, the original trailer for Billy Wilder's The Lost Weekend.
The Lost Weekend. So The Lost Weekend is based on a novel by Charles Jackson, which was a bestseller. And it follows 5 days in the life of a New York alcoholic played by Ray Milland, whose name is Don Burnham.
Yeah.
And it was the first movie to sort of delve into the reality of alcoholism as an addiction and as a disease. It was released in 1945 and won the Best Picture at the 1946 Academy Awards, which were the 18th Academy Awards.
Wow.
It's crazy to think about how
finally
long
mature.
Running this has been. So, Matt, why did we pick this one?
Well, first off, it's a classic. But it's also a classic we have never seen, and it's directed by Billy Wilder, who I'm a huge fan of, and you are as well.
We both big fans of Billy Wilder.
Yeah, he's made some of my favorite movies. But this one was a hole in my, you know, oeuvre, whatever. So I'd never seen it, so I was excited to get into it.
Yeah, I mean, I The Apartment might be my favorite movie of all time.
That's a movie that I show every girlfriend as like a litmus test to see if they're cool or not.
And this was, I sort of feel like this is a kind of companion piece to The Apartment in some way because it's also about life in New York to some degree. And it's also about, you know, it's sort of the anti-apartment in that where C.C. Baxter is a very passive character. Don is a very active character.
Yeah.
And I would like to throw this out as just sort of an entry point that we can start talking about the movie, Matt. Billy Wilder, I think, and I think he would probably characterize himself in this way too, is a very like utilitarian director.
Right.
I mean, there are no like fancy shots. You know, there's no like moving camera. There's no like sweeping. There's no like very self-consciously artful shots in the movie. However,
there are some really good ones though. There's a few that I wanted to talk about.
Well, yeah. So same here. So I feel like he gets this reputation as more of a craftsman than like an auteur. However, so many movies from this area and leading up to this year were basically just like filmed plays, where it's just like a lot of people standing around talking in like nicely furnished apartments. But this one, it very much uses the medium of the movies. There are a lot of different locations. There are a lot of interesting angles, a lot of like very poignant point of view shots from it, and I think that they are undoubtedly filmic. I think you as much as Wilder kind of gets overlooked in terms of like a visual perspective, I think he's up to a lot here that's more subtle.
Yeah, I agree, and he makes most of the film takes place in various interiors, a bar, apartments, you know, foyers, which he makes very visually dynamic in cool ways, just from, like you said, angles and point of view shots, which is great.
And yet,
interesting.
The perhaps the most famous sequence from the movie is where he's staggering up Third Avenue, trying to hawk his typewriter,
right?
And like all the signs are going by, which, from my reading, this movie was the first to do that technique.
I heard so. I can't confirm this, but when I was doing some research, I heard, because that looked like rear projection to me, but I also heard that they filmed some scenes with hidden cameras. Of the actor Ray Milland actually walking around New York.
Yeah.
And they filmed it with hidden cameras.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. And
I
bet you that's probably the first time.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. We should also back up and say this movie won 4 Academy Awards, not just Best Picture.
Yeah.
Also Best Director for Billy Wilder. Best Adapted Screenplay for Wilder and Charles Brackett.
And Best Actor, Ray Milland.
For Ray Milland,
gave one of the shortest acceptance speeches ever in the history of the
Academy. Is that true?
Awards. Yeah, that's true.
What was it?
It was basically like, oh, wow, thank you so much, Ingrid. And then he walks off stage.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I was talking recently about when Alfred Hitchcock got his honorary Oscar. I played the clip on this show when we did the Oscar special. As he just comes out, he accepts the statue, and he says into the microphone, thank you, and then walks off.
Yeah.
In like a what took you so long kind of way.
I like to think that when I get my Oscar, that's what I'll do. I just won't go.
Yeah, or maybe you'll do the Ben Affleck, Matt Damon thing and just like, fucking party.
Yeah, just ramble.
Yeah. Or like Roberto Benigni, like walked across the seat tops. You know what I'm talking
about? Oh, right.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'll just have a list of names, random names of people, and I'll just read off, or like fake names, and they'll slowly get more and more ridiculous.
Yeah. Hugh Laurie did an interesting thing when he won his Golden Globe, where he was like, I have so many people to thank who worked on, he was winning for House, and he had like all their names on little slips of paper in his pants pockets, pulled out 3 randomly and thanked like the hairdresser on
That's
the set,
great.
Which is great. But back to the Lost Weekend. What were some of the shots that you mentioned you wanted to talk about?
Well, the most striking shot for me was the shot that I'm sure you recognize too. It was the one where Ray Milland, his character of Don, is rummaging around his apartment, desperately trying to find the bottle of alcohol that he stashed, but cannot remember where he stashed it.
Yeah.
And he's leaning over like the day bed.
Yeah.
And it's a low angle shot with the ceiling lamp.
Yeah.
Sort of lurking in the background that we all know, the audience all knows that's where he hid the bottle.
Yeah.
But, and it's just sort of this like, and there are a lot of shots throughout the film like that where alcohol is sort of looming in the corner of the frame or the side of the frame as like the villain of the piece, which I really liked.
There is a lot of, you know, form mirroring or like reflecting substance in that way, which is, you know, it's always just kind of lurking in his mind. So it's always kind of lurking in the frame, which, and that leads me to talk about the shot where he finally discovers where he hid the bottle in the light, where he's kind of laying on the daybed and looks up and you can see like
just the tip,
the liquid and the outside of the bottle, like reflecting like the shadow of it ceiling. And that's really striking too. I mean, that's because it's also enlarged, you know, because it's like a shadow. So it, the looming quality of it is especially, you know, on display in that shot.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't know. That's something Billy Wilder, like you said, doesn't get enough credit for. One of the other things that struck me, just like initial reactions talking about of the movie, was the score.
Yes. Which we heard a little bit of.
We heard a little bit
previously,
of,
yeah.
Which is just wonderful. And it's very, it's like a horror score, which is just a theme throughout the whole movie that this is a horror film, basically. Yeah. Even the Don character says it. Says, you know, his novel is a horror story about alcoholism because he's writing a novel within the movie.
Right.
Sort of based on his life about alcoholism. And it's originally the movie had no score. And they tested it for audiences and audiences found it very funny because I guess Ray Milland's over the top performance sans music just seems sort of ridiculous.
It's not too hard to imagine that.
No, it's I can totally get it.
Yeah.
But then you add the music and it's really effective. Also, the very first score to ever use a theremin. And that's the most striking aspect of the score for me because it is that sort of, it feels like a sci-fi film.
Yeah.
You know,
it's the theremin is for those of you who don't know, apparently is an early electronic musical instrument controlled without physical contact by the thereminist.
Yeah. And it sounds very warbly and high pitched. And it's
which
just
became a hallmark of like horror sci-fi.
Totally.
Let me see if I can, we can play a clip.
Yeah, let's see if we can get that. But this it's every sci-fi movie from like the 50s that's like has like a flying saucer in it.
Yeah. Hold on.
Oh.
Okay, yeah. This is a theremin. So here we go. All right, a lot of vamping.
Yeah, a lot of lead up. See, there you go. Oh, wow, this is wonderful.
This is really cool.
But yeah, you know, that sound is sort of instantly recognizable if you watch any sort of old horror or sci-fi movies.
Yeah. I think it's associated, I don't know if it showed up in the Twilight Zone, but it's associated with that a lot.
Yeah, I wrote that down in my notes, Twilight Zone, for this film. Because, and it's just, it's really effective, and it sort of shows up in the first scene, which that scene is great. The scene opens and it, with three characters, the character of Don, his girlfriend, played by Jane Wyman, who's good, pretty great in the movie, and then his, the brother character, who we see briefly throughout the film. And the brother, so the basic plot is the brother and the girlfriend are trying to help Don, who's a recovering alcoholic, and the brother wants to take him out of the city away to a farmhouse somewhere. Yeah. And Don is, like a lot of addicts, very manipulative of both of them and pulls a lot of tricks to basically be able to stay in the city and drink. And there's a great scene where he has a bottle of liquor hanging outside the window because he can't hide it in the apartment, so he tied it to a string and he's hanging it outside the window as a hiding place away from his girlfriend and brother, and there's it's a very tense scene, and it's, we don't really know much about these characters yet, but it already feels very tense, and the score is a big part of that for me because it does have this, like, you know, you just have all these emotional reactions to hearing that sort of like theremin score, and then all of a sudden it's like, and we're sort of rooting for Don. I found myself sort of rooting for Don at that point to like get away with it.
This is the what's so interesting about the movie is like you want him to get, you want him to both get help but also succeed in
his tricks.
Pulling one over in his tricks, in pulling one over on everybody else. But yeah, so this was the first movie to treat the alcoholic character as a victim of a disease or like to really dramatize addiction and not portray the drunk character as like a clown to be laughed at or like a lush, you know, which is the stock character in cinema up until that point.
Yeah. And then it sort of follows this pattern that I think we're going to see a lot in the Best Picture winners. It's like the social issue, mm-hmm. Best Picture winner.
Yeah.
Which is a constant theme throughout, which I think we'll talk about when we talk about some other films, that there is a sometimes you feel like the award is given to the social issue and not the film.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So Martin Scorsese famously, you know, it bothered him so much that he didn't have an Oscar until he won for The Departed. Like he would deny it at the time, but he says now that like, yeah, it really bothered me. Mm-hmm. And he was asked in an interview once about Goodfellas losing to Dances with Wolves. And he said that one of the Academy voters told him that they vote for the movie that should win.
Yeah.
Which is a very interesting way of putting it. In this case, I mean, since we're talking about it, let's look at some of the other movies that were nominated this year
for
Best Picture.
Have you seen any of these?
No.
Okay.
So we can't talk about them too much.
The other films were Anchors Away, The Bells of St. Mary, Mildred Pierce, and Spellbound.
Okay.
Out of those movies, the only one I've seen is Anchors Away.
Oh, interesting.
Which is a very fun musical with Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra.
Okay.
That I saw. I haven't seen it in years since I was a kid, but I remember liking it.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, that's the one where Gene Kelly does a dance with Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
Which, you know, was just a memorable image for me as a kid.
Oh, sure.
But I have not revisited that film.
So no.
It's hard to say if The Lost Weekend was one of those times, you know, where a film, which we'll get to later on, Crash, you know, Crash was a film about racism, and it's very, you know, I think a lot of people have problems with that movie and that win. And that's a film that seemed to be the issue got the award, not the film itself. So it's hard to tell. I mean, I think The Lost Weekend is definitely better than Anchors Away. So.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have not seen the other
films. I haven't seen the other. Mildred Pierce has held up as like a noir, an American film noir classic. Bells of St. Mary's is a drama with Bing Crosby and Ingrid Bergman.
Okay, that probably didn't deserve it.
Which is probably just fine. I imagine that's a lot more, again, I haven't seen it, but I imagine that's a lot like the grandstanding that you see in so many old movies where it's like, I tell you, I can't do it. I just can't do it. And then it's like a 5-minute speech.
Yeah,
And Spellbound is a Hitchcock, also Ingrid Bergman and Gregory Peck.
Yeah.
So that one I'd be interested in checking out.
Maybe if we revisit any of those, or visit for the first time any of those movies on later podcasts, we can talk about how they compared to The Lost Weekend.
Mm-hmm. Another shot I wanted to talk about.
Oh.
Since we're talking about Wilder's kind of visual craftsmanship here. The first one in the movie that really caught my eye in this respect was when he first goes to the bar after his brother leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And there's it's the first time we see him take a drink in the movie, and he gets the shot of whiskey. And they talk for a little while, him and the bartender. And then there's a shot of him lifting up the shot glass from the table.
Oh, and the
rings. There are a bunch of rings of moisture where the other shots have landed. And I thought that was such a great, it was such a great way to indicate the passage of time, because it's like pulling one over on the audience also, like, because they seem to just be having this short conversation, and they cut to that shot, and it's like, well, actually, he's been here for much longer.
Right.
And he probably isn't even aware of how much he's drinking.
Mm-hmm.
That's also, it's just a, Wilder is so good, and this is another thing I wanted to talk about when we talk about story structure, is he's so good at these little moments assuming a grander poignancy.
Yeah.
That one in particular is like through the use of the camera. And there's one later on where there's a flashback sequence where he recounts meeting the girlfriend character, Helen.
Oh, man, that scene.
Are we talking about the same one where he
at the opera?
Well, there's that, which is which is a terrific sequence. But later, when he is to meet her parents, and he is waiting for them in the hotel and waiting for her in the hotel, and he realizes that he's sitting right behind them, and they're talking about like what a loser he is, or like he has no job, he lives off his brother, he's a writer, but he hasn't written, he hasn't finished anything. Like the dad is like very unimpressed by him, and like he is crushed by this. I mean, it's a crushing moment that reminded me a lot of in the apartment. When Baxter finds the broken mirror,
yes,
or when she when Shirley MacLaine pulls it out and he realizes the mirror is broken and that it's her that's sleeping with Mr.
Fred
Sheldrake,
McMurray.
Yeah, with Fred McMurray, who's great. I mean, listen, outstanding.
Love.
So I think that is, you can always find that in like the really good Billy Wilder dramas, is a moment like that that is not at all contrived, like could seem contrived in the hands of a lesser screenwriter, that just really assume really powerful proportions for me as a viewer. And that's the kind of stuff that I really respond to.
Yeah, I agree. I really like that he does a lot of foreground, middle ground, background framing.
Yeah.
Where, like, in that scene where the parents are right over his shoulder and then he's right over theirs in the reverse shot.
Yeah.
But that happens a lot in that same scene when he's in the phone booth and then, like, they're in the background.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with like, the alcohol lurking on the side of the frame, like, you know, a glass on a table or you know, in the lamp, like I said before. But he does that with characters, too, where there's people always to juxtapose with whatever is in the foreground, whoever's in the foreground, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, essentially what we're describing is like he pays so much attention to the composition of his shots. There's an interview that's on YouTube that everyone should check out of him giving like a, it's like an in conversation with at the WGA before he died. And he's like, he's making fun of these like artistic shots where it's, where they're like very self-consciously show-offy.
Yeah.
And he's like, the camera always has to be coming from somebody's perspective, which, you know, sounds like a very, like, bare-bones way of approaching it. And yet, he packs the screen with so much to see.
Yeah. I bet you he would not be a huge fan of True Detective.
Probably not.
And no one should, but sure. That's a different
Probably
conversation.
Not. But let's talk about Academy Award winner Ray Milland.
Performance. What are your thoughts? I thought he was great.
I thought it was great too.
Yeah, there is a couple moments wet. Okay. Well, first of all, we forgot to say this up top. We're gonna just spoil the whole movie. We're gonna talk about the ending. We're not gonna hold back any information. So if you wanna duck out right now and go see that, go rent it on iTunes or see it somewhere, do it. It's really good, it's worth it, and then come back and finish the pod.
Yeah.
So a moment I hated was towards the end of the movie when Ray Milland is having his delirium moment. And it was an over-the-top, it was a combination of performance and just the screenwriting. I really didn't like this. Like,
his hallucinations?
Yeah, I didn't care for
it. Oh, interesting. Okay.
I liked, I liked the bleeding wall and the bat and the mouse. I liked that stuff and it, visually, I thought it looked cool.
Yeah.
I just hated that was the moment where the film seemed to go a little over the top into like after school special territory for me, which a lot of movies about addiction, they walk that there's a fine line there, right? Because you want to show the horrors of addiction. So a movie like I think Requiem for a Dream does this sometimes where it goes a little too over the top and hammering home like, Drugs are bad. Alcohol's bad. Like, don't do it. This is a big warning for you. It almost goes into that reefer madness sort of territory.
Sure.
Where it goes over the top. And just, you know, the idea of, like, this delirium spell. I just thought it was, that's bullshit. I just really didn't care for it.
Two things I would say about that. One is like, we're talking about the horror movie elements.
Yeah.
I think that's the bat, like, eating the mouse, crawling out of the wall, I thought was, like, that was where it went really into horror.
Yeah.
Territory in a way that was like, it was interesting. I don't know if it was like as emotionally resonant for me as they probably hoped it would be. The other thing is what we are kind of inching toward this by talking about how it gets a little after school specially, which is that the ending is bad.
Oh, the ending is really bad.
It's just bad.
So, but it starts out with this really powerful moment, I thought. So a running thing throughout is just the very humiliating situations that Ray Milland finds himself in because of his alcoholism. And it's really great to just, they put a spotlight on it and they show you things that I think in other movies they would shy away from because they're very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So there's one scene sort of in the middle of the movie where he goes to a very fancy sort of cocktail bar and gets a bunch of drinks, but he has no money and can't pay for it. So he steals the woman sitting next to him. He steals her purse, goes to the bathroom and takes money out of her purse, and then goes back to his seat to try to like put the purse back. By then they've noticed it's gone and everyone is sort of like, they accost him and say, "You were sitting next to us. Give me back my purse." And sort of the entire bar is now staring at him. And it's this very humiliating scene. And he doesn't try to really lie his way out of it. He just says, "Yeah, I took it. And I took this money because I don't have any money."
Yeah.
And he seems so defeated.
Yeah.
And it's humiliating.
It's a crushing moment.
Yeah. And very uncomfortable.
Yeah. Oh, it's painful.
And there's a lot of scenes like that throughout the movie that I really loved because it's stuff that you don't see in that way with sort of, it's not over the top like, you know, in other movies of addiction, like, the Basketball Diaries, there's this like humiliating scene where Leo DiCaprio is crying to get into his mom's apartment because he needs money for drugs.
Yeah.
And that is sort of like this weird, it goes a little, it feels like it's less real than this scene. This scene felt like really, I don't know, just real in a way that I don't see in a lot of these kinds of movies until they kick him out of the bar and then the entire bar bursts into a song that they all know about how he stole her purse.
Yeah, yeah.
That part is weird.
It's, I mean, that I was, the breaking into song thing I thought was very funny because it was akin to, it was akin to when someone drops their lunch tray in the cafeteria and everybody like starts applauding.
Yeah.
That I was into. But yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorite parts of the movie.
I mean, but that scene, I referenced it to talk about the ending because there's a very a similar scene that I thought was very heartbreaking is where his girlfriend, Jane Wyman, has finally, she's like searching for him for most of the movie. She's finally found him. He's in his apartment and she puts him, gives him a shower and a shave and puts him to bed, and he wakes up before her and steals her jacket and takes it to the pawn shop to pawn it.
Yeah.
And just that moment, and she like sees him and she's calling after him and he can't face her and he runs because he has no money and he takes her jacket. And that was a similar scene of just like, and then she follows him and confronts him in the rain. It's very dramatic.
Yeah.
And it was a similar scene of just him like facing humiliation head on and not trying to like lie or I don't know. I found it was very effective.
It was. Yeah.
And then we find out that he didn't pawn it for money. He pawns it for a gun.
Yeah. To commit suicide.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, stuff like that is so much more resonant than the ending of the movie, which is basically she just talks him down.
That's where I was getting to. Has this happens basically right before that moment is this other humiliating dramatic moment that's really affecting and you're like, oh my god, this is bleak and great. And then right after that it wastes all that moment.
I know.
Because she's just like, you can do it, kid. And he's like, I will get sober.
Yeah. I think my biggest problem, first of all, it's a story that there is no hope in it. And I mean, as some background, like the book on which it was based, the author was not happy about the ending being changed. I mean, his version ended with, you know, the character not with no hope, basically the character not in recovery and not, you know, and unrepentant, basically.
Yeah.
Whereas this, I don't know why this is an argument that I assume that they've had a million times. They've been together 3 years, they say, in the movie, and I don't understand why it's this one that changes his mind.
It felt very like a studio was like, you gotta put a happy ending on it.
Yeah, I think that's We were talking off the air about there's a Vanity Fair profile about the production of this movie, and they were basically saying that it came from the studio wanting a happy ending, which is the kind of thing that in the studio system they used to be able to do.
It felt so unearned and so tacked on. It reminded me a lot of the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Oh yeah,
have you ever seen that?
Yeah, I have.
He's screaming, "They're coming for you!" And it's like that's where the movie ends.
Yeah.
And then there's just a completely new scene that's tacked on at the end. That's just like a general being like, "Well, we discovered the pod people and we're gonna all defeat them." And it's just like, where did this? It just comes out of left field.
We got him.
There's no like thematic buildup. It's so unearned.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's no reason why he changes his mind in like a second.
Yeah. I also just like, I don't, at the end of the day, I don't believe the happy ending.
No.
I don't believe that he's going to actually write this book now because he's been trying to do it the whole movie and keeps failing.
Yeah.
And I think what we're describing is, this pattern, this sort of very, like the last 20 minutes have this problem of like these like much bleaker, more resonant moments tempered by the like need to have a very pat wrapped up ending. And I think that's where Pauline Kael got her line on the movie, which is as follows. "The picture lacks fluidity and the slowly paced scenes seem overcalculated, with each colorful character and tense vignette standing out too sharply. Everything is nailed down to a meaning for us." End quote. And I think so much of the movie is not, I disagree with that for many of the scenes we talked about that we like, but that last 20 minutes, I think that's nailed down to a T. They don't flow into each other very well. It is very after school, especially. Mm-hmm. And so much of the movie up until that point is not that way. It's a very frank, honest portrayal of this guy's addiction. And then we're slapped. It's like a very jarring thing. It's like, where did this sudden change in direction come? It's like a very sharp left turn where you just, when you're like, you're driving and you just kind of like are thrown to one side of the car.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. I mean, it makes total sense that the studio would just tack it on.
Yeah.
How do you think, when I was watching this movie, a lot of what I couldn't help but think of Leaving Las Vegas, which owes obviously a lot to this movie. Mm-hmm. It's very similar in a lot of ways. It's sort of, it's about an... have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's great.
I need to.
It's Nick Cage playing a loser, alcoholic writer who goes to Las Vegas to drink himself to death. And it's very similar dynamic. There's a an angelic woman, which I do want to talk a little bit about that, the phenomenon of these angel women throughout this movie.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Shue plays this angelic prostitute who tries to get him to stop drinking.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very similar. And I feel like there's no movie that I've ever seen after having watched The Lost Weekend now a movie about addiction that I've ever seen that doesn't just completely owe, 80% of it to this movie.
Yeah.
Leaving Las Vegas, Basketball Diaries, Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah.
This
paved the way.
So it's like an archetype or a prototype. I mean, and stuff. Some of our problems with the film. I wonder how much we would have, if we were watching it in the
time
of it.
Yeah.
It's like this is the first time this has been dealt with on camera.
Mm-hmm.
So it is. We've been saying after school special, which I stand by, but it is like hard to think about.
It's hard to contextualize.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think too, this came out in 1945. Prohibition ended late 20s, early
30s. 33, I think.
Yeah. And, so 1945, the World War II is just ending and the generation of men are coming back home and probably struggling with a lot of these issues. I mean, I imagine a fairly prescient movie to come out in that year. Prohibition was in the memory of most people who were alive.
Yeah, and they mention it during the movie.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
sort of nurse character who we definitely did not see nearly enough of him. He was great.
Oh yeah, yeah. The nurse who might be a homosexual man.
Yes. So that's okay. So let's get into this. Just some scattered thoughts about, so the movie, it came out in 1945. It's not a shock that it has some reductive views of women and minorities. Number one, let's talk about the women last, because there's the most of them in it.
Yeah.
You know, the only two black guys we see in the movie is a bathroom attendant and one of the other alcoholics in the hospital.
Yeah.
And just that whole pawn shop scene where he's desperately trying to sell his typewriter, and then it turns out that the reason all the pawn shops are closed is because
it's Yom Kippur.
And it's very obviously just like a Gentile playing a Jew. It's Yom Kippur.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just like, yeah, of course, all the pawn shops are owned by Jews. And then, yes, this sort of swishy gay stereotype of a nurse in the hospital.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, all things I noticed, but it's like, of course, it's, you know, it's 1945.
Yeah. Since we're talking about the male nurse and the bit characters, can I talk about my favorite character in the movie?
Sure.
It's the coat check guy.
Oh, yeah.
So in the beginning of the flashback, you see how he met Helen, and it's at an opera. And he goes, he starts to get a Jones, and he knows that he's got some booze in his jacket. So he goes to like get his jacket from the coat check guy before the performance is over, and the guy won't do it. And he says, if I had people rooting around here, back here, it would be chaos. There have to be regulations. I think it's so funny that this coat check guy, who is like a stately older gentleman, believes so firmly in the integrity of the coat check system.
I really love that scene.
There have to be regulations.
Okay, and that, so let's talk about the women, because that scene ends with, so one of the problems with this movie is there's no like justification for why anyone would want anything to do with this guy besides he's handsome.
Yeah.
Like they repeat that. It's just like, of course women love him. He's handsome.
Yeah.
But he meets his girlfriend in this flashback. He meets her because they have switched coat check tickets. So he gets her coat. She gets his. And they meet, and he like throws her umbrella at her.
Yeah.
And is so rude to her.
He goes, here, catch, and throws it on the ground.
Throws it at her feet. And he's so rude to her the whole time. And literally 2 seconds later, she's like, well, I'm going to a cocktail party if you want to come. And like, she's all like hot and bothered by this guy who's been nothing but rude to her and just the worst guy.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I mean that's a problem. I mean, like there's the long suffering wife. I mean, she's not his wife, but for all intents and purposes, she's the long suffering wife character in this. And we get really no sense of like what her deal is. Well, that's not true. I mean, we know that she's a researcher at Time magazine.
Yeah.
And he goes, "Would you help me be the man of the year?"
Which, that's a good line.
Yeah.
My favorite line in the movie is, you're trying not to drink, I'm trying not to love you.
Yes. Yeah.
There are some
like horribly dated moments like that. But I mean, that's just great stuff.
Yeah, that's really good stuff. But all the women in this movie are sort of these angel women who enable him and help him for no discernible reason. Like my favorite character is actually the young woman in the bar, who I think it's safe to say she's a prostitute.
It's implied that she's a prostitute.
She's a prostitute, and she always hanging out at the bar that he frequents.
Yeah.
And I guess just has a big crush on him.
Yeah.
And there's another scene similar where it's like the turn is so swift where he, like, they make a date that he stands her up for because he's drunk. And then he goes to her apartment and she's furious with him. She's like, I waited up half the night, I got a facial and my hair done.
Yeah.
And then he's like, can I have some money? And she's like, no. And then he does that thing that's great in all these old movies where a man and a woman are fighting and the woman hates him, but then he just dramatically kisses her.
Yeah.
And then she's just like, can't help herself. She's like, here, take some money.
But she can't resist me.
Yeah. And he's shown no like redeeming qualities throughout the entire movie.
Yeah.
Which is a good portrayal of
it
like a struggling alcoholic, but there's no justification for why any of these beautiful angel women like enable or like him at all.
The only one who doesn't is the like the middle-aged landlady.
But even she is just like, well, I could have kicked him out years ago, but I decided not to.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, I do think it is it's a certain kind of addict. I mean, maybe it's specific to New York too. And the self-styled siren writes about this on her blog, which is that like, it's a guy who's like very smart and talented, who just like cannot get it together. He's like always a step, he's always a near miss, I think is what is the language that she uses, which is like the most heartbreaking thing, because like if he just had an ounce of like treatment or help or like meaningful help, then you know what could he achieve? And I think that's part of what is so heartbreaking about it. I think it's part of why we like him.
Yeah, and we also do like him because he is smart. Yeah, and
yes,
that's a thing that you see in movies about addiction a lot. And if you've ever experienced someone who has addictive personality, or has struggled with addiction, sometimes they're very, very smart and they can manipulate very, very easily. And maybe that's what we're supposed to like assume why these women are so good to him, is that he is just like a master manipulator. And I wish that was justified a little bit more, or we saw the manipulation a little bit more.
Yeah.
But that you do see some of that.
I mean,
he's like he's crafty about how he like goes about getting
drinks. And that's part of the reason why, you know, I think we talked about wanting him to succeed earlier. It's like we want to see these schemes play out.
It's like a heist movie almost. Yeah.
And that's why the moment where he steals the purse is so heartbreaking, because it's like, oh, like this isn't even like an entertaining scheme. He's just resorting to petty theft.
Yeah.
Now, you know, because he's out of you know, smart, crafty ways to get what he wants. And then he just like he mugs a liquor store with no gun. At one point,
I do love that scene. He just mugs the liquor store owner with force of will.
Yeah, there's also
he's not even pretending. He doesn't even have like hand in his pocket pretending it's a gun. He's just like, I'm leaving with this, and the guy's like, okay.
He's like so intimidated. So that scene starts with him going into the liquor store, and he goes, like a fourth of rye, please. And the guy goes, do you mind if I take my coat off first? That's like a joke, and he goes, no.
Give it to me now. I mean, yeah.
Or it's like, can I take my coat off? No. Not do you mind? But I wanted to. We got off on this track. I wanted to talk about Ray Milland.
Okay. Sorry.
I had only previously seen him in Dial M for Murder. Was the only other performance of his that I'd seen, and he's so good. He is such a good eye actor. I think his eyes look, they're kind of saggy, and they're always kind of darting around like he's uncomfortable or like he's fidgety, but he has enormous control, obviously, but when you look at him, you feel like there's something up or he wants to be somewhere else. And I think it's put to great use here, you know?
Another thing I really love about his performance is he plays drunk very well.
Yes.
Which I think is super hard. To do,
especially for
that
era.
Yeah. Especially in that era, like tends to be like people overact a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's pre-method, pre-naturalism. Or you know, that was just getting popular.
Yeah.
In the 40s, 50s, and he plays drunk so well. In so many movies, you see people, and like most of the time, it's for comedic effect, but they go so far over the top with the slurring and the stumbling and the goofy, like, you know, bad grammar.
Yeah.
But the best performers at playing drunk are when people realize that drunk people are always trying to act sober.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. So you play just drunk enough, like someone who's trying desperately to keep it cool, but just like can't.
Yeah.
Which he does such a great job. He does it in the bar a lot.
He's outstanding.
Or in his apartment when he's like in front of his, girlfriend or brother.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's just the right amount of like drunk around the edges where you can feel him trying to hold it together, and like at any moment it could just like crack.
Yeah. Also, this is probably more of a compliment to Wilder and Brackett's screenplay, but he's always putting his cigarette in the wrong way. Did you notice this?
I love that. And people keep taking it out and putting it back in
The right way. I mean, we were talking about how he's always a near miss earlier. I mean, what a very like funny human manifestation of that trait in his character that you see and like internalize.
Yeah, and it's funny because that's a great thing that can be played for like quirkiness or played for like sad.
Yeah.
Oh, you can't.
And both. And we get both.
Yeah, and it's great.
Yeah. It's really, it's really wonderful. Well, I mean, we've got about 10 minutes left in the show here.
I have one more thing.
Okay.
One of the other minor problems with it is the justification for why he's a drunk. And like, you know, you can become an alcoholic for any reason or no reason.
Yeah.
But the justification is his dreams are, he never achieved his dreams of being a writer.
Yeah.
Like his character is sort of this golden boy who gets published a lot as a teenager in college. And then he drops out of school because he's like, oh, I'm just going to become a writer.
Right.
I'm going to move to New York and become a writer. I don't need school. Look at me being so successful. And then doesn't achieve and ends up becoming an alcoholic, which they mentioned sort of in one scene. And I mean, I think I wouldn't want them to overdo it, but they could have hit it a little bit harder. And I guess it wasn't a huge deal for me, but I did notice. I was like, oh, the justification for like why he is the way he is not super strong.
Yeah.
But then reading about the book, a big part of the book is that the character is implied that he's a closeted homosexual, which makes so much more sense. The movie and that character makes so much more sense when we realize that, oh, he is, you know, drinking because he can't be who he is openly.
Right.
Which, you know, maybe would, you know, if they ever remade this, did another adaptation of the book, would be more interesting to explore.
Certainly
now.
I mean,
or as a period piece or something.
I certainly don't fault them for removing those elements of the book from the screenplay, just because if they're already breaking these taboos by portraying addiction on screen, I mean, it was 1945. The country's not ready.
No, I mean, I'm not blaming Billy Wilder for taking it out. I'm just, you know.
I mean, it's an enormously progressive movie. I mean, so many of Billy Wilder's movies are.
Yeah.
And this one, you know, treating the alcoholic like alcoholism like it's a disease is an enormously modern idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's no, like, there's no prescription of, like, well, you just need more self-control. It's like, no, like, this is an affliction for him.
Yeah, and I like that they don't, the movie is not so heavy-handed where that's, like, that's not the conclusion that they come to by the end. It's like, you know what? Alcoholism is a disease. Like, the girlfriend, Jane Wyman's character, states it right up top. Like, oh, he's sick. He needs help.
Yeah.
That's just sort of an assumption in the movie rather than, like, some grand conclusion that they come to.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, in a heavy-handed social movie like A Crash, it's just like, oh, my God, I guess good white people can also be racist.
Oh, my God. Oh, I think we have to do Crash next. we've been hyping it so much.
Yeah, it is a good companion piece to this movie as like a social issue.
Yeah.
Best picture winner. Yeah.
So why don't we, I mean, we have a couple minutes left. We have several minutes left.
Okay, great.
But why don't we kind of try and close the things down with just sort of a quick sort of wrap up of sort of our overall impressions.
All right. So final thoughts. I think definitely recommend it to for sure any fan of Billy Wilder. It is an interesting piece of his filmography because it's very early. I think it's his third or fourth film.
Mm.
And it's the one he did right after Double Indemnity, because he wrote Double Indemnity with Raymond Chandler, and Raymond Chandler was a recovering alcoholic who actually the stress of writing that film made him relapse, and Billy Wilder watching that made him want to make this movie about a recovering alcoholic. So it's interesting to like see where this falls in his filmography, sort of in that early period where he was doing a lot of noir and a lot of drama. Before sort of post Sunset Boulevard, he went pretty much hard into only comedies. He made very few dramas, so it's interesting. It's a
I cannot wait to revisit Billy Wilder on another episode.
Yeah,
whenever we eventually get to The Apartment, which again is my favorite movie of all time, we might have to have a supersized episode for that one.
Maybe we'll just watch it and do commentary.
Yeah, download our commentary track.
Would you put this in your top five Billy Wilder movies?
Lost Weekend?
Yeah.
I would. Yeah, I would. I would rank it above some of the mid-period comedies.
It's tough because he made so many good. I don't think it's as good as Apartment, Some Like It Hot, Sunset Boulevard, or Double Indemnity, but it might get into that fifth slot.
Yeah.
I do like 7 Year Itch, though, too. I would say.
Oh, you know what? I haven't seen 7 Year Itch.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
But I would put it, it's like, you know, there's all his work is great, but there's, it's I think, maybe a tier two Billy Wilder for me.
Sure. Yeah.
Slightly below, but it's still great and super obviously worth checking out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd have to really go through these and think about them.
It's tough because he's made so many good movies.
I know. I mean, I want to say the only Criterion release of a Billy Wilder movie is one called Ace in the Hole.
With Kirk Douglas?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I have not seen either and really, really want to see. But that doesn't make for entertaining radio, so I won't dwell on it.
Any other final thoughts?
I think we hit all. I definitely recommend the movie. If it's not clear from what we've been talking about, I think there are some problems with the ending that stick out. And most of the Billy Wilder movies, the dramas especially, are like this. It's amazing how relevant to daily life they still seem.
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of great, very like human character moments that I found very heartbreaking. And that's the kind of stuff that I want to do in my work. Mm-hmm. So like definitely check it out for those reasons.
Yeah. Also, just to hit on one more specific, I do love, so I'm going to make a basketball analogy. You know, in basketball, the great teams, you have your stars and your starters.
Yeah.
But the great teams are the ones that can, like, nail the picks around the edges. Like, the role players are, like, the late-round draft picks who you can just, like, fill in the gaps, which this movie does so well. All the small characters and the ones we've mentioned before, like, Doris Dowling plays the prostitute. She's great.
Mm-hmm.
Another character, tiny character that I really loved, was the John who comes in.
Oh, yeah.
Who's in, he has got only about like 10 lines, but he's terrific.
Yeah.
He comes in as Doris Dowling's character is making a date with Ray Milland's character that she eventually gets stood up.
Yeah.
But she has previously made a date with this John character who comes in, who then she is now blowing off in this scene.
Yeah.
And I don't know, his
very funny scene.
His like innocent joy that that then becomes sadness is very funny.
Oh, it's could have been great.
But that all the around the edges characters in this film are great.
Agreed. So check it out for that reason as well. Mm-hmm. Which brings us to the end of this first episode of Best Cast with Matt and Colby.
Yeah.
We hope to see you guys soon. And it also brings to the end this episode of Young Persons Radio. Mm-hmm. The filibuster. We'll call this one not a single call because nobody can hear what we're talking about because, again, this is pre-recorded. So I want to thank everybody for listening. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at Colby J. Smith and Matt on Twitter at
Strick Bomb.
Is it Strick underscore bomb?
Nope, just Strick Bomb.
Okay, just
StrickBomb.
And, stay tuned for more great talk shows here on Radio Free Brooklyn today. Points of Order is coming up next, and the great sports talk show, so we're really excited to see what they have in store. We will be back next week, and Best Cast will be back soon as well. So thanks, everybody, for listening. This has been Young Persons Radio on Radio Free Brooklyn. I am your host, Colby Smith. We will see you all soon. Bye.